There was a problem that Sam Friedland had. He was the head of the Food Fair supermarket chain in Philadelphia. He took his problem to Drexel, the technical institute, back in the middle of the 1900s. And he said, how can we automate the grocery process? Well, the dean of the institute at Drexel wanted to help, but he wasn't sure how. So he brought it to his school. And it wasn't actually his faculty who helped. It was a student, a graduate student, a 23-year-old named Bernard Silver. He overheard the request, and it just fascinated him. So he discussed it with one of the lecturers in mechanical engineering named Norman Woodland. Together, they figured out that they could crack the problem. Woodland had learned Morse code when he was in the Boy Scouts, and he wondered if the same principle of dots and dashes might be used to encode product information. Turns out that it could. At the same time, I'm fascinated by the story of Gillette. Gillette wanted to figure out how to create deodorant that was gel-based, but they didn't know how to do it. That was until a former engineer for the Bic Pen Company began working at Gillette. They had solved the gelification problem long ago, and he was able to bring that to Gillette when it came time to create this new type of deodorant. Doctors have created smaller injection needles based on mosquitoes. Alexander Graham Bell made the phone's diaphragm after going to audiology school and understanding how the human ear works. Even Ford, who was credited with the assembly line, really didn't create that himself. He based it on William Klann's work at a slaughterhouse. William Klann was one of his executives, and he heard the idea and said, I think we can do it. Today, we want to talk about innovation. At the heart of innovation is what I just described. It's called associative thinking by scholars, but it's really the idea that you take a solution from one context and figure out how to make it work in your context. To talk about that, we have a guest I'm really excited to introduce to you. His name is Dr. Steve Johnson. If you're Googling Steve Johnson right now, as we talked about in the pre-meeting, you're going to find a lot of people who may not be the Steve Johnson we're talking to today, including some innovative gurus out there in the world. But Steve and I have known each other for 5 or 6 years now. Feels like longer because we're such good friends. I want to make sure that I mention to you, he is a former major in the Army. He has done some lifelong learning work, both in that context, but also with organizations like Southern New Hampshire University. He and I really overlapped at National University, where he's actually in the process of building out the RISE Lab, Research, Innovation, and Strategy in Education as a collaborative. The reason we were introduced was because I used to be a chief innovation officer, and he effectively was the chief innovation officer. And so we became fast friends and have really talked about some fantastic things over that time. And I'm excited to share some of it with you today in terms of innovation as leadership. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. Curse of the common name. Thank you so much for having me on this. I'm really thrilled to get to participate today and share what we've learned together and maybe even replicate some of the conversations you and I have had in the past that have made light bulbs go on for me, have made light bulbs go on for you, and have always been really interesting and hilarious at the same time, I think.
That's right. We always have a good time as well. So I hope some of that comes out today. So look, I can brag on you all day, and I think so highly of you, and you know that. But what else would you like to say to our listeners to have them hear about you and your past? Anything else that you'd like to sprinkle in there?
I'm a serial generalist. I think Kyle and I before you came on today, where he was asking me about, you know, hey, you were in the Army, you're in the defense industry, you're in higher education. Like, what's all that about? And I think I really like the book Range. If you come across the book Range about generalists, and I think that's something to bring into our conversation today is like that, you know, you're talking about innovation is taking something out of one context and introducing it. And I think the generalist is someone who you have context to draw from that you can bring into other situations and help with problem solving, critical thinking, those kinds of things. And I just like, so if you go like, how did some guy who was an English major in the army end up like coming through these spaces and ending up in an innovation organization? I think as much as like the jobs I've held and that kind of stuff, it's the experiences and the vast array of those things. So just adding that into my bio there.
It's funny. I think that I think Range is one of those four or five books that comes up often on this podcast. Epstein really does a nice job saying there's very few people in the world who have really made it because they're such specialists, that generalists really do rule the day. And I agree. It's an excellent read. I would recommend it to our listeners. So, Steve, I'm going to start with the same question for you that I ask all of our guests. So, we are going to talk about innovation today, but it's within a leadership framework. And so in the very first episode of our podcast, I shared with the listening audience, my favorite term that I associate with leadership is the word intentional. I know you can have accidental leadership, that's possible, but it's pretty rare, especially if it's going to be successful. I'm curious, what is your favorite term in conjunction with leadership and why?
So it's a great question and a hard one to answer all the time. I mean, when as you're asking this, is kind of like makes you take pause. I think because I came into leadership and my early experiences in leadership were framed through the military and the U.S. Army specifically. It's servant leadership, all the things you're brought into are about. Why I'm leading is not for my own accolades. It's not for moving up higher and greater responsibility in its end. It's because I'm serving a higher purpose and I'm helping bring out the potential in other people to serve that higher purpose as well. And so for me, that's been really crucial. And in fact, when I've been in leadership roles along the way, in organizations that aren't really focused on higher purpose, I've felt a little lost, which is why coming into higher ed, I mean, you're here to help people seize opportunity. And so it's a great place for servant leadership.
I love that. Obviously, our school is known for servant leadership. In fact, I might argue externally, I think more people associate Gonzaga and our School of Leadership Studies with servant leadership. I think internally, we would suggest adaptive leadership is really more of our specialty, which includes servant leadership.
Sure.
But it's interesting, Steve. I know you're a voracious reader. You may read more than anyone else I know on a daily basis. And what's lovely about you is you share those findings with others. I have read so much in the last several months in the higher ed context specifically about this assumption that most administrators just want to get ahead. They want to be in control. They want to put themselves into a position of authority. And I really find more administrators feel like you do. We're in this for the students. We're in this for the experience. We're in this to try to, promote something societally and in terms of the greater good. So I love hearing that. And you've had that your whole career, right?
I feel like I have, yes. And I think you're right. I think somewhere things get lost, between what's a leader and what's a manager as well, right? So, the two sides of the same coin. But often I think to your point, my experience in higher ed, people come into it with those exact same reasons. Hey, I'm here for students. I see how we can make things better, but then often we get you're entering into a system, a highly bureaucratic system, and it less time to lead and more time to be a manager and try to manage things. And I think that's where why sometimes you run into cynical leaders along the way in that space, and they kind of lose that servant viewpoint of like, hey, I'm here. The best leaders I've seen, come out and they're like, you see them, they'll bend over backwards for their faculty. They'll bend over the backwards to do anything for students. And the leadership is not you. there are times where there are boundaries and there's management and directive leadership, but it's so much more of like, where are we going? Where are you wanting to go? How can I help you get where you're trying to go? And those are the kinds of questions that I see come out from really, really great servant leaders. They know how to set a vision and then get behind people as they're trying to get to that vision.
One of the things I feel like you reinforced in our, as we've known each other, is the notion that it's much more about guardrails than it is about shackles or walls. You really just sort of set the direction and make sure that there's no way to fall off the edge. But other than that, there's a tremendous amount of flexibility for your folks in your department. I think they would echo that.
Well, I'm glad you at least I left something with you along the way. And a lot of that comes through. I had an opportunity through professional development. I came across. I don't think he's a really like well-known leadership theorist. His name Nick Obolensky. He's out of the UK. As BAE Systems, they're sort of a UK based defense company, and so we got introduced to this idea of complex adaptive leadership. But what's really beyond the title of that, what's very compelling about Obolensky is there's this balance, and he goes through several different metaphors. One of them is Taoism and the yin and the yang idea of leadership, where exactly what you were saying, there's these places where I offer an innate mission and vision, but then there are clear specific objectives we're trying to achieve, or and then I have boundaries and kind of know I so I'm going in a direction where I have lots of opportunity to vary within there and find my own way, but I also know that if I'm kind of out of that boundary, I'm not where I'm supposed to be in my organization.
For those listening at home, we're not going to get much into Obolensky and
No, I'll stay away from
polyarchical leadership, but
that.
it's worth a couple of Google searches. It's really the notion that leaders are leading leaders, and it puts in nicely a framing of, if you've got a very young organization, that's probably not the style you want to pick. But as an adaptive leader, there are definitely times you're going to be leading people who don't need a ton of sort of formal leadership. This is an excellent choice in those contexts. So highly recommend that little rabbit hole for folks who've been.
Yeah, so, sorry to go down too deep in that,
No,
but
not at all.
I get
Not at all.
excited, Jeff, and so.
I know. I like it. So that's one of those Easter eggs people can explore on their own.
You go.
Okay, so you and I, let's get to the heart of it. You and I share the innovation part of our jobs and our past. I like to think that I'm still innovative. I'm in a bit more of a bureaucratic position. It makes it hard sometimes to be as innovative as I know you get to be every day. When I first got to St. Leo as the Chief Innovation Officer, I was largely brought there because I was seen as a creative person. I hadn't done a lot of study of innovation. However, over time, I did. I went to summer institutes. I met Clayton Christensen and Jeff Dyer and Peter Senge and talked about, the fifth discipline in practical, tangible ways. What does systems thinking look like, and how does it work? So rather than having to focus on invention, which is very different than innovation. So invention, right, is something that's never been seen before. That's an amazing skill if you can do that, or something you can generate at some point. But what we're talking about is what I tried to allude to at the start, which is bringing ideas into your context that other people have used to solve problems. So I guess my first question for you is, how do you frame innovation? And then I'd love to just start to explore some of your associative thinking in my terms, and then however you start to think about innovation in your terms.
Sure. I'm going to wander to answering your question if you can give me a little latitude, because I would say where my commitments are before being an innovator, I'm a futurist. But I find that approach, the those frameworks of foresight and futurism that are out there are actually really important to helping find where should I be trying to innovate. Because I do see, and I know you've experienced, as we talked about, Jeff, is you see a lot of people who they're jumping from shiny thing to shiny thing in search of being innovative, And it's a lot of energy that often goes nowhere. And so,
I think of that as symptom finding versus problem finding. Is that fair?
it's symptomatic versus it's addressing symptoms often, or seeing something, that can, band-aid solution versus like, hey, let me get to the root cause of what's going on and how do I need. So a couple of quick examples of how does futures thinking inform that? We play a game. So one of the things I do and why I read so much is I've gotten very much into signal scanning. And Signal, as the Institute for the Future calls it, if you know that organization, is sort of it's a an artifact of the future that exists in the present. So a common example is sensors. I wear an Apple Watch, not forcing Apple there, just not a commercial here. I know it's a podcast. I wear an Apple Watch. It has a very small sensor, and they continue to get smaller. But the signal there is sensors will continue to get smaller, be affordable, and become more and more ubiquitous in our existence. And so, to the point where it's not if so. The thing with the signal is you start in the present, my Apple Watch and sensor, and then what happens if this scales? If this scales, I will either be wearing more and more sensors. I may have sensors embedded in my body, those kinds of things. So we play a game where you take three random signals and put them together and look for insight. So we did one. I'll make this very quick. We did one with as the world approaches 2 degrees centigrade average temperature increase, we're
Right.
going to signal one is you're going to have climate refugees. Signal two was in about 10 years. Roughly, we're likely to have babelfish technology, meaning clear, not just interpretation, but translation and clear communication through technology. And then the third one was
All out
that,
Star Trek.
all of Star Trek, right? Or, well, a babelfish, a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a. And then the third one was the third random signal we pulled was blockchain technology scaling for clear exchangeable credentials across geographical boundaries. And so you start to piece together the three signals, and we ended up with this sort of scenario where you're going to have climate refugees as they perhaps potentially move into other countries. Language barriers that exist today will become far reduced in their needs. And potentially for education, you're going to be able to have places where you have teachers and students, none of whom may speak the same first language or have the ability to speak another language, learning together. And so that was kind of the space we were imagining. This is not a so anybody listening, this isn't a prediction. We don't use the future to predict, but rather to like think back into the present. And then with blockchain, now, if my home has been destroyed by some kind of climate event or something like that, I don't have a paper diploma anymore. My educational credentials are still going with me. And so I can still continue to learn in a different geographical location. And I can take my credentials and build my credentials with me where I go. So it provides new ways to have opportunity. So as you build these with people, it's fun. I did not come up with these by myself. It's a collaborative effort of people really thinking through. And you get some stuff. One of the takeaways was the future is nomadic. People don't have to be as constrained. But the I think the one that brings it back to the present was somebody said, well, what technology is all of that going to happen on? So, well, if it's people moving, the affordable device there is going to be something akin to the mobile smartphones we're using today. And so for me as an innovator, that comes back to like, where's the handheld learning experience? What is that? What does that look like if I have to learn and I can't, if I'm on a very small screen and I'm holding up my cell phone right now, like I don't love reading books on my phone. So like, how do I get learning? What does that experience look like in those things? So for me, that's an example of you take the future to start going, oh, handheld experience. That's an opportunity to innovate that has legs. Another quick one, I was at an ASU about 3 weeks ago. They had a 100-year EdTech design summit. It was fascinating. all these different groups. I was in a group talking about human genetic modification. And so to take you through about 3 half-day long sessions, the group started with lots of angst about, well, what about how are we going to be cognitively modified? I was very worried about that one. Memory, longer living humans who are now stronger. And we were very concerned about, that equity. But equity became this thing. It's like, oh, as we worked into this space around genetic modification, what it really meant is you have new equity needs into a different dimension. And so it'd be very hard. We're struggling with how does education address all of these new facets? And you get to this point of like personalization and individualized learning and the technologies around that just got a whole lot more important because our ability to like try to move learners as cohorted packs through learning just became really difficult if Jeff Borden can learn because he's got a cognitively modified brain can learn German in 3 weeks and Steve Johnson can take years and years and years of German and barely speak introductory phrases as an example, right? Like we need different learning paths. Yeah, sehr gut. Yeah, that's about the best German you're gonna get from me. But I think for me, those are examples of like I'm not saying those are the places people listening to this should run off and start innovating. Rather, this is kind of a framework to start getting back to like where should I be starting and looking and thinking about bringing technologies together to solve real problems. So genetic modification may not happen for 50 years. But we're not that great at handling diversity and equitable raise right now. And starting to get on that path will help that problem.
So, Steve, let me ask you a super pragmatic question. One of the goals of this podcast is to try and give leaders definitive actions they could take when they get done listening to this, they could go back into their offices, go to their culture, go to their community, go to their organization, and do something. When I'm talking about innovation with leaders at different levels, I use the associative thinking example that Dyer gives, where they put hats on a table and they have people attack a problem that the company all agrees is a problem, but they say, take that hat out, and whatever that hat is, you work for that company. Imagine solving the problem as if you worked for that company, right? So you work for Coca-Cola, you work for the BBC, you work for Google. How would Google approach this problem we're having as a company? I think that's a powerful exercise. There are Fortune 500 companies that do that for days on end. They do that for 2 or 3 days with literally everyone in their organization. That example you just gave, another powerful exercise. How could a leader listening to you talk about taking that sort of reverse engineering approach for the instructional designers listening, that universal design approach, that backwards engineering approach, how could they do that and try to get to a place where they are innovating for today based on some of those future problems?
Yeah, great question. I'm trying to bring an organization exactly through this right now. So I think, and in a space where people react to this idea of futures thinking or foresight is like, oh, that's very squishy. You're just out there trying to be a wizard predicting the future. And it's like, again, I say no. You nailed it very well. It's more understanding likely things that are going to be shifting in the future to get back to like, how can I start working on that systems problem now? So I like how you phrased that. I just wanted to emphasize that. I think one is starting to learn about that particular field. I took about 2 years ago, I went through I was wanting to learn about Coursera, so I just jumped on and then I found they had this futures thinking specialization by the Institute for the Future, who I was familiar with that organization. And so, it took me a couple of months to get through the work, but it was a great set of courses taught by Jane McGonigal. If you don't know Jane McGonigal, I think she's out of the Stanford D School originally, but she's a game designer
Reality is broken, right? Is that the book she wrote?
and a great one called Imaginable. That's another one. So I was gonna say, if you don't have the time to go through like, a few months of going through Coursera, Her book Imaginable lays out a lot of the futurist principles and why you're trying to imagine the future. It's really a strategic thinking. At the end of the day, it's practicing strategic thinking in ways organizations I've been, 2 or 3 years out, everything's going to be the same. You're really not starting to address where are there system problems out there that are in front of us that we're going to have to confront, and if we're not ready, our organization will struggle. So step one, learn about futurism yourself. I think then make it okay for not everybody's going to gravitate, but you will find people will come out of the woodwork who love this kind of
Right.
thinking,
Yeah.
and they become the people you bring into this kind of stuff. Because I've just found, like, I talk about those people like, oh, I was thinking about it, and they will feed ideas into the pot. They love that kind of stuff. So I think that helps.
A champions council, a champions guide.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then where I'm working with my team is I'm getting them. We've started doing. I learned this from a guy named Steve Brown, who I've worked with at when I was at Southern New Hampshire University. He was sort of our resident futurist there. Steve has his own consulting firm, the Futures Collaborative, and it's called the Signal Swarm. And we, a Signal Swarm is just simply you. We frame this with three trends that matter: climate change, the rise of AI, and social cohesion issues with humans. And then so that's sort of your horizontals, and your verticals are what's wrong, what's working, and what's hopeful. And you always have to end with what's hopeful, because if you finish with what's wrong, you're just going to curl up in the fetal position and want to think about ice cream and like those kinds of things. But you use this framework, and then you ask your team, hey, go find two signals and put them into this matrix.
Yeah.
And over time, they're starting to connect, see things, and you can have these rich discussions where people go, oh, the future is nomadic. And when you're in a group and has this, you just feel this insight of like, ah, wow,
Right.
that is something I need. If people are going to move, they are going to be less chained. They're going to need to move for climate reasons, but those same technologies will enable people to move more than we are now. So I think that's how I see developing a culture. And really, to your point of like the champions are out there, it doesn't take that long, and you can build it up. And in no time,
Platform.
You do a few signal swarms, you
Yeah.
can get to that game I was talking about. Okay, let's take three signals and you all work them together and see what insights you can pull. And then you're up and running.
Yeah. Steve, we could talk for so long. I have two other questions I do want to get to before we bring in. I think you even mentioned Kyle's name. He'll be joining us here in a little bit, but I want to go back to the notion that in order to innovate, you really do need either a tremendous amount of information coming from reading or ideally from lived experiences. I always joke with higher education executives that one of the problems that higher ed faces is there's very, very little in the way of outsiders coming in. Most provosts were deans, most deans were chairs, most chairs were faculty. They've all been in the same, vertical the entire time. You did work with the Army. You did work with BAE Systems. You brought those solutions with you into higher ed, and I think higher ed is better for it. I've seen some of those solutions. Could you talk to us a little bit about how you bring some of the work you've done in the past that's been successful, how you translate that into work that will matter in your current context?
It's a great question. Thank you for that. You're asking me how do I make the donuts? I don't know. They emerge. I think one is just metaphor. I think the other thing besides the work experience, my academic discipline is English and studied literature and composition and those things, and a great respect, and I've always enjoyed playing word games and that kind of stuff. So metaphor is another component of doing what you're saying. It's the metaphor is the connection of something of dissimilar thing into a new space where it suddenly makes sense. And so So because of that love of metaphor, I think it's enabled whatever it did to my brain. I do a lot of connecting to your point.
At Horizon Credit Union, community is who we serve, and helping you grow is our goal. Your path is our purpose, and together we can make a positive impact. Whether you're ready for a checking account, a home loan, or a team that cares about your dreams, doing business here does good in the community. Discover the difference and open your account today or find a branch near you at hzcu.org. Horizon Credit Union is an equal housing opportunity lender insured by NCUA.
So, Steve, last question before we bring our Gonzaga student into the mix. I know from our history together, you, as I alluded to before, you're a voracious reader. You also take a lot of demos. And I know why you do it. You have to, in order to be aware of what's going on out in the world and try to vet them to see what you want to do internally. But you're also dealing with a lot of spin, a lot of marketing, a lot of people that are over-promising and under-delivering. I'd love, just tangibly, practically, could you tell our listeners, how do you do that? How do you approach that? What framework do you use for those demos?
Sure. Thanks. And that catches it well. I think we start, my organization, for the past 2 years, we've been sort of an internal consultancy to my university. And we're not even going to have time in here to go through like the change leadership stuff that's really part of this work. You can't be somebody who's working on sustaining innovation without having change leadership tools in your kit bag.
Right.
Now I'm an external entity, so that changes some of our work. But I think at the end of the day, my team, one of our stated values is curiosity. So just the start of these kinds of demos is like, we're just curious about what's happening. I think we're interested in where a tech company is going to come tell you about the problem they're solving, which may be different from the problem you have. And I think to one of your earlier points, Jeff, it's often a symptomatic problem. We lost you again, but okay, you're back. Nope, there you are. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. It's often a symptomatic problem. So I think we always come into it as, the role of my organization is also not to acquire enterprise tools. And we make that really clear. Like, we're here to test and learn and understand. And so I think we start with that futures framework I was telling you about. We also, as we're learning those things, we're talking to, and I'll just go with our sustaining approach. We talk to people who we identify as champions in the organization. This is somebody who, if we give them something, they would love to try it out. They would love to take it for a test drive and learn with us.
Yeah.
So I think taking it from that helps us to do this idea of like, think big. Wow. If we had a capability, you could do this. This could have a system level impact on something. Then step two is start small. All right. So how do we get a glimpse of that? Where's the signal today that gives us a glimpse into that? If a student's using it, or it's solving an administrative problem or a staff problem or challenge out there.
Yeah.
How do we learn from that? We know. We look at taking whatever is being pitched to us, like, oh, that's great. Can I get a 6-month contract? Can I get a 3-month contract? I'm going to ask a lot of questions. Your company is going to benefit because you're going to have a lot of questions you're still trying to answer as you're trying to. We often work with people in the front end. And then we're going to learn and iterate. And so sometimes that's iterating with the same tool. That's sometimes trying to find something else.
Oh, that's great. So I hope that people who are in positions where they probably should be curious, I hope that they got, I really took from that you've made it a core value. And so once it's a core value, then the operations sort of can follow. I love that.
Thanks. I mean, I think my team has agreed, if you're not curious, you have no business being an innovator.
Yeah.
So it's got to be, it's part of your DNA is that curiosity piece. Yeah.
I think that's an excellent segue to bring one of our Gonzaga School of Leadership Studies students in. I'd like to introduce our audience to Kyle Denton. Kyle is a director of a digital transformation organization. He runs a 7,600 person program, $70 million budget. I mean, big work that Kyle's doing. I like to think about how Gonzaga is pairing and partnering with our students. We have some exceptional people in our DPLS program, getting their doctorates, in our master's programs, getting Oregon Commel leadership degrees. And Kyle is absolutely a representation of that. So he's a PhD candidate with us. I am just tickled that he's part of our family, that he's chosen us to hopefully kind of finalize his degree with his doctorate here. But I want to bring him in to note that he has not only worked in civilian areas, but also in governmental and military areas. He's been recognized with the Civilian Service Achievement Medal, the Seattle Federal, he's a member of the Federal Executive Board, the European Commission, and I happen to know he just got back from Brussels, where one of our professors had an immersion class, and he was over there. So he's, I don't even know how much sleep he's working on right now, but we'll find out here in a second. Kyle, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. And you just cut out a little bit there. Yeah, just got back from Brussels with one of the organizational leadership master's program courses that Gonzaga has, which has just been phenomenal. I mean, my experience with Gonzaga has taken me across 12 countries around the globe, international summits, you know, NATO headquarters. I even learned how to climb mountains. Yeah, that's a class. I grew up Pacific Northwest, Seattle area, and I used to make fun of all the quote unquote sandal wearing wool sock folks. And now I've flown all over the world to climb mountains with people from Gonzaga that have stayed connected with each other for decades.
I'm going to have our marketing person grab that soundbite because that was brilliant. So thank you for that. Separate from this podcast, Kyle, I'd love, I mean, you actually just gave a little bit more of a bio there for yourself. Anything else you'd like to say just in terms of your leadership credential as we start on this conversation?
I think, man, Steve really captured it, that servant element, like the people for others ethos with Gonzaga, something that really resonated with me. And, I'm always learning. I'm not the expert, and just figuring out, from a leadership perspective, that relationship with other people is something that's really valuable to me.
Yeah. So if anyone's brand new to the podcast, what we try to do is now broker a conversation between this leaderly expert and an emerging leader who's not really emerging. He's a leader in his own right here with Kyle. But we're just going to now have a conversation about what we talked about in the first half of the podcast. So Kyle, you got an opportunity to hear the conversation Steve and I were having. What does that bring to mind, either from your studies or questions or however you want to take it?
Oh, so I really love the talk about like different tools and strategies, the signal scanning. And one of the things I noticed was, the talk about Babelfish, and, you mentioned Star Trek. He mentioned Hitchhiker's Guide. And I'm a sci-fi reader as well. And so I was actually curious about some more of those tools and tactics, for example, like reading science fiction or movies and some of that creative stuff, Steve, what are some other ways to get ideas that you've used before?
Sure. Cool. And I would say, before I answer your question, it's been great to chat with you on the sides of this podcast and get to know you, Kyle. I hope I can give you answers worthy enough of for the questions you're asking me. You're such an impressive student. So it's been really cool, and I hope we can keep talking after this podcast sometime. In short, I think if you know people who love reading science fiction or watching sci-fi movies and those kinds of things, I was, as part of my childhood, was we were in line for Star Wars in 1977 when I was in first grade. So I remember going, yeah. I think the connection a lot of people trace has to do with imagination And you know, that's part of this relationship to like curiosity. And I was very fortunate about a few months ago, I was on a panel with Brian Alexander, who in higher education is a well-known futures thinker. And we were sitting at a table just kind of having lunch talking, and the conversation went to sci-fi, and we started talking about Dune and how it was thinking about a future. His I think some of his stuff was thinking about, you know, climate change and how Frank Herbert had imagined this planet and some of that stuff. But it's not uncommon, not that all to be a futures thinker, you have to be a sci-fi geek, but I think it's you're somebody who's comfortable getting into a space that's not in today. And I think that is really difficult for people, especially in organizational frameworks that are really often focused, especially through financials and things like on next quarter, next year, and even outlying years is like a 5-year strategic plan. And if you've lived through a 5-year strategic plan, they're probably bad after 12 to 18 months. But some of that is because of this imagination thing. And so I don't know, it's a prerequisite, and I don't know that I per se have brought anything specific from a sci-fi movie, maybe you have, Jeff, into it. But at the same time, I think you can go into like, I love going to like look at old Jetsons cartoons, if you remember the Jetsons. And
Yeah.
like, it's a great example of what futurism is, which is they have this vision of the future, and you're like, oh, they were so wrong. But when you get into it, it's like flying cars. Okay, that was wrong. That was a little too crazy. But like, there's a robot vacuuming. Huh. Hey, he's got a computer on his desk at work. Oh, interesting. You know, and all this stuff was like such a comedy in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's like, well, yes. And so it's not right. We don't live with transparent walls around us and fly around, but there's things you can pick up. And so I was like, the sci-fi mind is, or like you brought up Star Trek. There's lots of things like in tricorders and communicators that in the 1960s are like, whoa, that's way out there. And then I look at this, yeah, that little device you're holding up, the smartphone, it's like, it's here, right? It's there. So,
So Steve,
I,
I would
yeah.
suggest maybe Kurzweil. You know, Kurzweil, as he has talked about the future, he also goes back to sci-fi quite often. But you know, if you look at he was one of the first people I ever saw in a keynote. He gave a keynote to an audience of 2,000 people from his basement, and it was a piece of curved glass in front of the audience that was 1,000 miles away. And he only had, you know, he was only dressed up from the waist up. He had pajama bottoms from the waist down. And as he was talking about it, he was talking about how one day the combination of our smartphone today, of, you know, something like Google Glass or those goggles that we might be able to wear, you can walk into the middle of a heart. And we can do that today. It's possible. If you put on that VR headset, that's a different kind of learning than we've ever had at our disposal before. So I think as you look at how sci-fi pushes reality, and at the same time reality then gives sci-fi some legs, I think you can start to see it all around.
It never quite pans out
Sure.
like the example, but it's there, right? The
It
thread.
inspires. It
Yeah,
inspires something.
absolutely. Yeah, no, that's well said, Kyle.
So that's a such a really great insight there. And one of the things I'm looking at is, how do you then inspire others within an organization? How do you find those champions, or even build those champions where you kind of identify them as the people who will go and play and test and kind of share those ideas? Like, what have you found works? I know you mentioned the Rise Lab, and how does that kind of play into the strategy within an organization?
Sure, I'll come in. Great questions. I'll tackle this a couple ways. One is what I call champions. If you go look at a change curve, you're really talking about early adopters. And I think, you know, early adopters are about 10 to 15% of any given organizational population. You have to sift through and find them. So there will always be people out there. You know, in my role for the last 3 years, people come to you like, oh, look what I found. I'm doing this thing. Let me show you. I want to be doing what you're doing. And great, let me help you do that. And I think, you know, the exact wrong instinct for a leader is to go, I'm the leader, I'll call you when you're needed, and kind of push that way. It's rather like, this is my army. This is who I need to embrace and get to help me here. So with the Rise Lab, our mission is around how to make the future of higher education better for non-traditional working military learners, especially those from underserved populations. That's gives us our servant focus also, so that, you know, there are all kinds of like, hey, we can go innovate here and it's going to build to the bottom line. It's like, okay, go do that. Have fun. We're focused in an area. And so I think strategically, there's two things. One is the last 2 years, like I said, I've been an internal consultancy. That is a lot of change leadership and knowing about change curves and how early adoption starts to bring then sort of the next group along and those things. You have to be ready that it's not going to be like Clay Christensen disruptive innovation, and it's often going to water down the vision you're trying to impact. But that's okay, right? You're bringing people into new space. When you think about artificial intelligence right now, anybody adopting any kind of generative AI, a teacher allowing it to come in to students and the work that they're doing, those kinds of things, that's positive steps forward. That's people learning, being curious. And so if it goes a little slower than you'd like it to, that's okay. You want to kind of get that momentum. But I think the, trying to move or make systems level, those often end up being point solutions. I guess that's a really how I would say. And you want to get from point solution to really start helping people see, like, this is systems change that's going to be happening. And if you are not thinking about it now, you will get washed away later. It will overwhelm you because of acceleration, how technology has accelerated since 1950, and what we're seeing in several emerging technologies that are now coming together. So AI, VR, XR, machine learning, which is a different kind of AI than generative, but as these things start to integrate more than we're even aware, it will change how learning happens and these things. And so in those cases, I think you have to, you try to pull your champions, but you have to figure out how to do the work in a way that's not just going directly back into the organization. You have to start to like demonstrate this is change and it's right here and we figured out how to do it. And Jeff probably knows more about this from his work at St. Leo's than I do, but I mean, that can be really difficult.
I think about, so Kyle, I don't know if you've noticed it. I've noticed how often Steve's talking about the curve. And, you know, I think back to the giants in change management, Kotter, and even Kuznets and Posner, as they talk about leadership, the challenge of leadership, and it revolving around change, there's a curve. And I know that people, you know, Steve and I have talked many times, we want people to get there faster. But sometimes you just have to allow that curve to manifest and get people to a place where they're incrementally moving closer to the direction that you want them to get. And I think that's what, you know, the leader that can keep their eye on that ball really sets themselves up for some success. Does that resonate, Kyle, with some of the stuff you are talking about and learning in your class? Yeah,
no, that's really good. And it's so I think like kind of the next question that builds from that, you know, you mentioned Kotter and change leadership and kind of narrowing that definition of the champion to the early adopter, which I think is good to kind of place it there. Cause I mean, I love the term champion, but people use it for almost anything. So to use like Roger's definition, early adopter, and then change agents for that change leadership part, AKA the people who are helping the champions, I would say. How do you look at scaling your army of change agents? Because, you know, Steve Johnson, army of one versus building your lab and finding others who help drive that that incremental, sometimes slow adoption, like Jeff mentioned?
Yeah, it's hard because every case I've ever tried, like, I have this framework, and like how reality plays out is always different. It's humans fall are involved, right? I think before we go directly answer, there was I was looking it up. There's this old proverb. It's if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And so I think it's a balance of what you're trying to do and what you're trying to achieve, which kind of goes to one of my earlier points of like, hey, if I'm trying to actually make substantial change into my university and get it to do some things correctly, that is going to be a long-term change-led innovation project. And to your point, I have to have champions. Often what I found though is the reason you pick that champion in the early adopter is they become the evangelist. And it's not about Steve Johnson getting laurels. Oh, that Johnson guy's back doing innovation again because he wants to keep his job and keep moving forward and make his name. It's like, no. And in fact, our approach is very much to be in the background. We want to make sure that champion is the hero for bringing what they, because they are heroes, but they're doing something difficult and we're just there to support them through that work. That often speaks volumes to other people. So an example, we had done a small innovation project, and it's not even done incubating yet, where students have an online AI-based resource to practice job interviews, and shared it out. And suddenly lots of people are like, wow, this is interesting. I really want to do it, because the champion shared it out and the champion is standing in front of it, not the strange guy from the innovation unit pushing his wares. Right. And I think that makes, so if you're trying to go into that then breeds to your question of like, that breeds then that next line of people who are interested and want to do stuff. They're like, oh, somebody else is doing that. It's working. Wow. Let me try. I want to try. And that's how you start to shift there. So planting those kinds of seeds, I think back to the, but where, what's possible and how do we get there and how do we start building technical paths or how do we leverage technology, not even to solve a problem, but just to understand what the impact of it will be. That's where you can go fast. And for us, it's like finding other universities that are asking the same kinds of questions about learners. How do we collaborate with them? Our president, Mark Milliron, often says this isn't about how to make National better than other universities. It's how do we make National better with higher education? And having a leader who like lays out that kind of understanding of the work, this is a higher ed problem, not a national problem, helps us do that. So like, how do we find a tech partner? People asking the same kinds of questions. And you can move fast because it's not about implementing something, it's about learning. And so in fact, mm-hmm. I have an assessment specialist on my team, and her job is to very much build the kinds of things we bring into our innovation hub as an experiment that we're learning from. And then again, starts to be, it's a prototype, right? We're trying to get rapid prototypes in place, not a prototype of a specific product, but a prototype of an experience and a solution to something. So
nice.
I still go back, man, the intentional matters, those concentric circles of trust going out and having your early adopter or your champion actually showing it to others. That's intentional. Having an assessment person to tell you, is this working? That's intentional. It so matters to think through your stuff and really do it purposefully. You guys, I have so enjoyed this conversation, but unfortunately we have to bring it to a close. I'd like to give you both sort of one last thought, one last, what did Jerry Springer used to do? The last word or something like that, whatever it was. I'd like to start with Kyle and just give you a chance. Whatever you're thinking about what we have talked about, how would you kind of sum it up, synthesize it, or even spark another question worth exploring?
Ooh, I mean, all I have is a bunch more questions, but I just want to say thank you. You know, some of the key takeaways is, you know, that creativity, signal scanning, and just some thought experiments, making space for that. and then moving fast by moving parallel with collaborators. That's a great way of thinking about that. And then, you know, those volunteers, the interested champions and change agents, making the space for them. So those are the four kind of takeaways I got from this to go mull on and see what I can put into practice. So I really appreciate it, Steve.
Wow, I appreciate you because you just gave me my notes. I was like, oh yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Oh, that's exactly what I was trying to say. Thank you.
I can see that on a shirt, right?
Yeah. Love it.
Kyle's giving us social media points for the school. He's giving us merch. Yeah, he's doing it all. So Steve, let me ask you the same question. Last thought, final word. What do you have to sum this up with?
Two quick things. First thing is, Jeff, I am very grateful for you. I really appreciate you for doing this kind of a podcast. I think I hope you have lots of listeners. Not from our conversation today, but I think your bigger project, really, really important, what you're doing in your vision here. So I know you kind of like, oh, I'm a bureaucrat most of the time. This is a visionary thing you're doing, sharing knowledge in a different way. And I hope you have an assessment specialist who's I'm just kidding. I think the other thing, you know, you're very kind, like, oh, Steve, you're an innovator as you're introducing me and things like that. I don't think of myself as that as much as I think of myself as somebody, getting back to the point of the beginning questions of like, this is how you lead people to be innovative. And so that's often what I'm trying to achieve. I'm not out to blow the doors off of something or I don't have my own specific projects in mind, but rather I'm really trying to help facilitate an organization to see those things. And so I just, as you were asking me some really good questions about leadership, I think that's one of the things I hope this audience can take away from it is like, you don't, to be in this kind of work and to be a generalist in this kind of work, you don't have to be, I mean, again, I'm not technically trained. I think I had an engineering track in management of information systems in 1993. I can program the heck out of Turbo Pascal if you need me to on it. but you have a different toolkit, and organizations need people to not necessarily go, this is where we need to innovate or this is my disruptive idea, but rather to bring talented and really smart and excited people together to, they'll show you and they will put their heads together and like bring you into those spaces too. So just wanted to be real, real specific about that. Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Oh,
this
gosh.
Is great to hang out with you always.
Yes. Thanks to both of you. So once again, for the listening audience, Steve Johnson, Kyle Denton, thank you for spending some time talking to us about innovation, how that intersects with leadership, what that can look like, maybe even should look like in certain contexts. We hope that everyone picked up something tangible that they can take with them and try tomorrow, and then maybe a list of things to try over the coming weeks and months. But as always, thank you for your time. We hope that you'll listen to the other podcasts in the series. Good luck and good leading. We'll be right back.